My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome to this week's episode of Mysteries and Monsters. So before we dive into this week's episode, we have a couple of announcements to make. Firstly, we've got a bit of a problem with our Facebook page. It seems to have disappeared from everybody's news feeds, and we don't know what's happened. We've checked, we've not been reported, we're not under review, we're not suspended. It's just stopped appearing since Thursday, so bear with us. We're going to keep chasing up our reports and hopefully we'll have some news. So hang in there and apologies for any disruption, but we're not sure what's going on. All right. And on a more positive note, from the next episode, we're going to be joining the Paranormal UK Radio Network. So we hope you appreciate our new partners. They're going to be releasing the show first, but nothing else is going to change. Same content, same host and same release day of Monday. So if you want to hear it through those guys first, you can, and make sure you add them to your podcast app or however you download your episodes. That's Paranormal UK Radio Network. We'll still be releasing the episode, but it's going to end up being slightly later in the week. So I'm looking forward to it, and thank you everyone so much for the best wishes and support over the last couple of days. It's meant a lot, so thank you very much. Don't forget, if you can find us on Facebook, good luck. But we've also got a new page which is called Mysteries and Monsters Podcasts, so you can like that. We're just using that to highlight the podcast at the moment, so bear with us, like I say, in regards to the technical issues we've had. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. You can subscribe to us on YouTube. Don't forget, you can support us on Patreon. And we will dive into this week's episode. And I'm delighted to welcome that our next guest needs no introduction in the field of cryptozoology. Ladies and gentlemen, Ken Gerhardt. My guest today is one of the most well-known figures in the field of modern cryptozoology, Ken Gerhardt. Ken has appeared on numerous TV shows and documentaries, including Monster Quest, True Monsters, Weird or What, True Supernatural, as well as recently appearing in the latest Small Town Monsters film Terror in the Skies. Ken has travelled the world investigating some of the most well-known cryptids, including Bigfoot, Nessie, winged beings of variety, and even werewolves. Ken, thank you so much for joining me today on Mysteries and Monsters. Welcome.
Thank you, Paul. It's absolutely an honor and a pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, likewise, likewise. So, I tend to always want to drill down into what got people fired up for this wonderful pursuit that we all love so much, Ken. What was it that kind of tipped you into this wonderful, weird world of strangeness?
Well, of course, people ask me that a lot, Paul. It is kind of a weird calling, if you will, to get into this stuff very seriously. But, I can't really put my finger on one thing. As I get older, I think there were a number of epiphanies in my young life that maybe led me down this path. But primarily when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and mind you, I was already very much into monsters and animals and, you know, wildlife and all those things as a young boy. But when I was 8 or 9, I saw a short news segment about Bigfoot on the television, and they showed the Patterson-Gimlin film and guys holding foot casts and things, and I was just, something just clicked. I just thought it was, you know, amazing that people were actually claiming they'd encountered these huge, hairy, man-like creatures in the forests of North America. But as I got older, and I was always kind of reading everything I could get my hands on with regard to cryptozoology, but as I got older, My mother was a huge influence, and she used to tell me stories about the Yeti and the Mothman and a lot of these different weird creatures. And I was able to travel around with her quite a bit. She was a travel agent and very adventurous, and she took me to with her to the, you know, South America. We camped along the Amazon and visited Machu Picchu and the Galapagos. We traveled to Australia and the Outback and, you know, Asia, different places around the world. And wherever I went, I was always kind of digging into the local legends of, you know, legendary beasts and mythological creatures. So it's just been a lifelong passion. I've never had a sighting. People always ask me that. I think I may have been pretty close to a Bigfoot at least one occasion, but I didn't actually see it, so I can't say for sure. I consider myself very blessed to have had the opportunity to follow in the footsteps of, you know, all of my heroes, Bernard Heuvelmans and Ivan Sanderson and Roy Mackel and Grover Krantz, all these great pioneers in the field of cryptozoology. So it's a very exciting undertaking.
Yeah, I mean, I've often noticed that whenever you've done any work or anything, you're very humble in regards to the inspirations, and you mentioned several of them there, and it all seems to stem for a lot of people of our generation, Ken, from that kind of golden era of the late 50s and 60s when cryptozoology kind of came into the mainstream, obviously with the Shipton Yeti photo in the early 50s, and then obviously the Bigfoot explosion in mainstream press anyway, and then, like you say, it kind of went global when the Patterson-Gimlin film sort of hit. And obviously over here in the UK, we've always had Nessie kind of popping up every now and again, depending on on that kind of thing. So it's always been very interesting that, and I've said this to a few people over the last few weeks, that for me, I think we're kind of re-entering a golden age of cryptozoology, you know, in part to people like yourself, Ken. So do you feel that the field's probably at its most popular at the moment?
You know, I think these things tend to go in cycles, Paul. I mean, I remember, as I said, when I was younger and, you know, I got into this stuff in kind of the mid-70s when there was a lot of cryptozoology type news stories out there, the Patterson-Gimlin film and other... I neglected to mention a moment ago that when I was 15 years old in 1982, my family vacationed at Loch Ness. And I was an ambitious young lad, so I actually did attempt field research. I had an 8mm movie camera, and I interviewed the locals. So I was attempting field work at a young age. But I think things are cyclical, but obviously there's been a boon due to social media and just the speed at which information is disseminated these days. Many people, young people, have access to all types of information and knowledge. And it's very encouraging. I do a lot of talks to young people at schools and the zoo and so forth, and there are inevitably young people that really have a huge advantage in terms of the knowledge they possess about different cryptid creatures and different facets of cryptozoology. So that's a double-edged sword there, Paul, because in the information age that we live in, there's also, I think, a lot more disinformation out there in terms of, you know, just fabrications and hoaxes and, you know, things getting warped and misinterpreted. And so it's very difficult, I think, or more difficult perhaps these days, to get good information on some of these subjects.
Yeah, I think you're right there, because it is a double-edged sword, because I think that the proliferation of technology is, you know, you'd look at, you know, the amount of channels and information you can get. You can type anything on YouTube, you know, in the world of cryptids, and you will eventually find a channel or numerous pieces of footage on it. And it's obviously with the technology itself, it's perhaps easier to hoodwink, I think is the right word for to get people in, especially when there's, you know, YouTube suffers, I think, certainly with the fact that there's a financial benefit for anything that's a spectacular video of anything unusual.
Yep.
So it is, I believe you're completely correct in that assumption that it is a double-edged sword. And it's, do you think it makes you, do you think in that aspect it's got harder for you to as we say in the UK, sort the wheat from the chaff?
Oh, yeah, much harder. And So, in fact, a new book that I'm working on right now, which is primarily a Bigfoot book, is intended to do just that, because I find that there's so many sort of falsehoods out there and you know, sort of facts that have been long lost and forgotten. And so people, the newer generation of Bigfoot people specifically, and we have to acknowledge Bigfoot is, and the Yeti are kind of the rock stars of cryptozoology still.
Yeah.
Nessie isn't far behind, but,
yeah.
You know, there's so much that people have forgotten about, you know, the pioneers and the 50 years of research that, you know, that's gone into the field. So, yeah, it is more difficult, and it's honestly one of the frustrating parts of my job is that, you know, people are constantly funneling me different videos and images and things that they found on the internet and asking me what my opinion is, and a lot of those things are items that were debunked long ago, or you know, there have been conclusive, but I guess it's hard for people to connect with that sometimes. So it's, you know, it's kind of straightening out the misunderstandings is a big part of the job.
Yeah. It is. I mean, you see these things come, you know, as they say these days, these things tend to go viral. I think the most recent example I can think of off the top of my head was the lady that claimed to have filmed an elf running out of her house the other week.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which by all accounts, according to the original post that on her Facebook page, it was her daughter, and her friend said it was her daughter, but then other people saw it and it just went mad. I've never seen any. That's probably the biggest viral thing I've seen hit this year anyway.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. That does tend to happen a lot, where things just kind of, you know, they get out there quickly. And as you mentioned earlier, I mean, different, for obvious reasons, because online traffic is kind of the new currency, people will grab those items and put a spin on it and put it on their website or attempt to get people to click on it, so.
Yeah, yeah. I know in my social media circle, I've taken the role of that guy who always points out.
Is that you?
I'm afraid it is, Ken. It is me. There are several podcast message boards where I'm sure a few of the members gnaw their teeth when they see me responding to something. But that's probably because I'm a bit of an anorak in some of these situations. And like you say, you know, I've been reading about these things since the early 80s, as you know. Probably not far behind yourself, you know. And for me, the catalyst was the Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World series, which was first time I'd ever seen the Patterson Gimlin film, and that, you know, with the greatest respect, probably changed my life because it just opened my mind to the possibilities and potentials of the world outside. So, for you, because obviously, I think your first book was focusing on the monsters of Texas. So. Was that kind of a natural starting point for you to say, you know, look at the environment around you or perhaps what you were interested in the most and then build it from there?
Well, when I had decided to really try to make a name for myself in the field of cryptozoology, I approached one of my idols at the time, who was Lauren Coleman, who's one of the pioneers in the field, and he suggested that I write a book. Well, upon much deliberation, I decided that, you know, it made the most sense to sort of tackle a subject that was logistically, you know, something that I could handle. So I always tell researchers to, quote-unquote, play the home field advantage. That is, if you have a particular mystery that you're interested in that's accessible to you and that you can you know, travel easily and gather the most information, you know, on site. So there's nothing like getting boots on the ground. So that's why I kind of decided to focus on initially the mystery of something called Big Bird, which is, you know, the kind of a thunderbird, a giant winged creature that's been reported in South Texas and seemed to have a density of those types of accounts coming out of South Texas. So I moved to San Antonio, where I live now, which is kind of in the nexus of a lot of that activity. But then, yes, I began writing, or I co-authored a book called Monsters of Texas with Nick Redfern, and again, being that we're both based in Texas, it was, you know, Texas is a big state, mind you, so
yeah.
there were a lot of road trips that ensued, but worthwhile ventures, but so any budding researchers out there, I would say, you know, definitely, you know, as a romantic as it seems to want to travel around the world and, you know, to the jungles of Africa or wherever, you know, if you can manage to put something like that together, you're obviously not going to be there the amount of time you'd want to be to gather all the information, data, and so on and so forth. So it's always good to kind of to play that home field advantage.
Yeah, and I think you kind of find out whether you really do want to proceed in this field when you kind of, you know, go out there for the first time, I would suspect, Ken, in a professional basis, because at the end of the day, it's not just your own personal curiosity you're then trying to satisfy. It's dealing with that data and analysis and as you say, boots on the ground to put this out to, you know, as you refer to, for public consumption.
Yep, absolutely. And I appreciate you, you know, that's a strong point you just made, because if you're wanting to truly make a contribution to the field, you know, that's the other thing you have to look at in terms of what can I bring to the table that, you know, and in the case of the big bird, although many researchers were aware of the initial sightings back in the 70s, I'm not sure anyone had ever done, since the 70s, had done a really extensive investigation in some of those areas. And so I was able to reconnect with some of the original eyewitnesses and dig up new reports and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's just, and everyone's different. Some people are, you know, just kind of interested in cryptozoology and they want to do it for fun, and there's nothing wrong with that. If people want to, you know, take time off for their jobs and go out and pursue Nessie or any of these things, I highly encourage it. I mean, it can be a very, very rewarding thing either way. So.
Yeah, very much so. And I think I was fortunate enough to speak to Seth Breedlove recently about their new documentary, and it was nice, because as soon as he mentioned it, you were the first person I think of. So I think it's quite strange how certain people in the field of cryptozoology, you automatically, for better or for worse, Ken, so I hope you take this the right way, that you tend to identify a certain researcher with a certain cryptid. And for me, whenever I've heard your name mentioned over the years, I've always thought of you as the Thunderbird man, in that kind of, you know, because that's, I've always kind of seen you as one of the leading lights in that particular niche.
Well, I appreciate that, and that is definitely a facet of cryptozoology that's often neglected compared to, you know, the hominids and the aquatic cryptids and so on and so forth. But it literally was as if a mantle was passed, because prior to my getting in the field, of course, the leading researcher into winged cryptids was probably Mark A. Hall, a colleague of Lauren Coleman's, who wrote an excellent book on Thunderbirds. But and I was able to connect with Mark as I was writing my first books on winged cryptids, which was a great help. But tragically, he passed on a few years after that. And so, I, you know, I feel in many respects that at least I had an opportunity to kind of, you know, take the mantle from him and all the work and research he'd done for many years and keep it alive, because there are literally, I get, you know, a sightings reports on a fairly regular basis from people that have nowhere else to turn, Paul, when they've seen something with a 20-foot wingspan flying over their ranch. You know, they inevitably find me, and I'm happy to sort of amass all of those reports and try to you know, try to investigate that phenomenon.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting as well, because you know, I've spoken to this to several of my guests in regards to what I consider any member of the public that goes out into the press, regardless of whichever of these wonderfully weird creatures they may have experienced. I find it both baffling and incredibly brave, because as I'm sure you'll agree, Ken, the amount of normal people that go forward are usually met with nothing but absolute ridicule from whichever, be it television or newsprint and online even these days, that there is a instant negative response to whatever anybody says that is beyond the norm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it depends. I find that people are actually, I guess a lot of it because of the popularity of different television shows and social media and so forth, that I do find there are more people that tend to be open-minded, at least. You know, I wear a lot of Bigfoot t-shirts out in public, Paul. I just, you know, obviously I'm at a lot of those events and people are always giving me Bigfoot shirts. So I'm always out in public with a Bigfoot or a cryptid shirt on, and, you know, it'll strike up a conversation. And I find at least that, you know, more often than not, people are being sort of gracious and, you know, seem to be open-minded to the possibility that there might be something, some bit of truth to some of these legends. But of course, most people don't have a lot of information on it. So they've read a short news article here, there, or watched one 30-minute television program. So they just don't have a lot of information to go on. But for example, when people ask me, do I really think that Bigfoot exists? I say, well, you know, I've spent a better part of a lifetime immersed in the evidence and the research. So I think I can make a qualified conclusion based on those many years of research. I would say, yes, I'm convinced they do exist. Mm. You know, other people don't have that luxury because they've lived other lives and haven't spent more than 15 or 20 minutes looking into the problem. So.
Yeah, and I also think that for people who contact yourself and you know, and other notable investigators, you know, as you've referred to Lauren Coleman, and there's people like Lyle Blackburn and Linda Godfrey is another prime example. I think that these people find it, this may sound like a strange leap of faith, Ken, but for some of them, I would imagine it's similar to counselling, because they know they can come to you with this incredible experience, knowing full well that you will listen to them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that is actually one of the most rewarding parts of being an investigator into these kind of weird mysteries, because you're absolutely right. But when I do interview people, give them a call over the phone, reach out and talk to them, and I can almost, once they've told me about their experience, I can almost hear the relief in their voices, because they finally, maybe they weren't even able to confide in their wives, husbands, family members, because, you know, they were, you know, sort of given a funny look or whatever, but, you know, yeah, so, you know, there's a therapy, you know, there's a, even if I can, and, you know, 99% of the time I can't resolve or explain what it was perhaps they saw or think they saw, but, you know, I can always assure them and tell them, look, there are other people that have claimed to have seen this exact thing. Sometimes I'm even able to reward them by saying, wow, I'm looking at my database and there was a sighting of something similar to what you saw, only, you know, 24 miles down the road, or, you know, whatever. So, I mean, so yeah, and being the specialist in winged cryptids, of course, I get most of the people that have had experiences with thunderbirds or flying humanoids, but I get all types of eyewitnesses. But yeah, it's a very rewarding thing to be able to provide even a modicum of closure to these people, to let them know that they're not crazy. You know, the thing, what they think they saw might exist, and other people have also described it, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. I mean, has it? I mean, once you kind of, you know, most people I've spoken to have said that once you dip your toes in this pool, you've got to be careful where it may end up taking you, because it tends to, once you open one door to one particular cryptid or strange phenomena, other doors seem to automatically open afterwards, and it causes some kind of domino effect. So for you, obviously, like you were referring to earlier in regards to, you know, Bigfoot and Yeti as being the rock stars of it, and wanting to kind of look into, you know, as you mentioned, and I completely agree, an underappreciated part of cryptozoology, which tends to be, you know, people are more concerned about land and water based cryptids than ones in the air. Did you, you know, when you started investigating the stories of the Thunderbirds, did you expect that to lead into people claiming to have seen modern day pterodactyls and pteranodons? Or did you get the dinosaur reports alongside? Essentially, when you were looking into the big birds, Ken, I'll rephrase it because it was a very long-winded version of it. Was it just people seeing birds at first, and then the dinosaur sightings followed, or was it kind of, did they work come together?
No, actually, well, kind of quite the opposite, and also, you know, it becomes rather confusing because a lot of these cryptids kind of get tangled together in different ways. For example, the first account that I ever received, the first witness that I ever interviewed, did in fact describe a pterodactyl type of thing. A little bit smaller. He said it had about a 6-foot wingspan, and it had the classic long tail with the sort of diamond or flan shape on the end, which is indicative of a Ramphorhynchus or Ramphorhynchoid, which is a type of pterosaur, but not necessarily a pterodactyl. But regardless, that was the first winged cryptid report that I received, and that was one of the things that kind of catapulted me into the big bird mystery. And despite the name, which was a media invention, incidentally, like Abominable Snowman and Bigfoot and others, the reports that emanated out of Texas in the 1970s, it was kind of a mixed bag, but some people did in fact seem to describe prehistoric looking creatures with reptilian features, while others described them as definitively avian and bird-like. And then there were even some flying humanoid Mothman type creatures that got into the mix. And case in point, Paul, I have a giant map here on the wall in my apartment, and I've got little tacks in this map of the United States, North America really, where people have described or reported different types of winged cryptids, and these tacks are color-coded. Black for thunderbirds, red for pterosaurs, and orange for flying humanoids. Well, it's interesting, there are clusters on the map where all three types of winged creatures overlap, and where you might have a report or sighting of a pterosaur, you might also have a thunderbird or a flying humanoid report in the same vicinity. So you wonder if it's a matter of interpretation, that people are kind of interpreting these, whatever winged cryptid is out there, they're interpreting it in different ways, or if it's more of a supernatural type thing where you have certain locations that are more prone to have activity, or hesitant to say, but even some type of shape-shifting phenomenon that can take the form of a different type of winged anomaly or something. So it's, I really don't have any good answers at this point. But there do seem to be inexplicable links between all of these different types of winged creatures.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating, and obviously at the moment we've got a what seems to be a concentrated flap going on in Chicago, which seems to be incredibly baffling because it seems to have come from nowhere, really. I mean, often skeptics will point out that certain cryptids suddenly become popular after a particular film's been released or something's been shown on television, for example. Which I think is quite an assumption to assume that everybody watches television when you know, viewing figures are falling through the floor across the world for a lot of people. So I think sometimes that's a bit of a leap of faith. But did that surprise you to see such a sudden concentration in an area that particularly didn't have any kind of history in that kind of field?
Well, yeah, in some ways it did surprise me, but in other ways not so much, because with regard to the big bird of South Texas and Mothman, the Jersey Devil, a lot of these winged cryptids creatures, they have happened in flaps. That is, most of these sightings have happened in a concentrated area over a short amount of time. So that's a common pattern in terms of a winged creature appearing suddenly out of nowhere and then being seen dozens of times in one specific area. I think the surprising part of, you know, I think to most people was the fact that you're talking about the third largest city in the U.S., which is, you know, a pretty highly developed and urban area. So, yeah, it did kind of come out of nowhere in terms of, you know, certainly wasn't expecting the volume of reports and sightings from Chicago. Now, I should point out that there's a lot of controversy surrounding those cases. And, you know, I don't want to get into that too much, but it all has to do with, you know, kind of like sourcing, you know, how many different sources or channels of information is this filtering through. So, that said, that the area around Chicago, again, going back to my infamous wall map here. I do have a high concentration of Thunderbird and pterosaur type sightings in northern Illinois and near the Chicago area. So the fact that Illinois has traditionally had, as the Small Town Monsters film indicates, is Illinois has traditionally been kind of a hot spot for reports of weird flying creatures.
Yeah, and that's odd in itself because, if you were going to suggest an area for where people may see flying reptiles or pteranodons or creatures of a similar nature, you wouldn't expect those reports to emanate from so far north either.
No, absolutely not. And in fact, I have pterosaur reports from Alaska, which is pretty mind-boggling. But they're pretty much all over. The pterosaur types have been reported from all over North America and the world, really. But I have there are some kind of active areas. Recently, I investigated a spate of corroborating pterosaur sightings from Oklahoma, a specific part of Oklahoma, and also from northern Georgia in the States. So occasionally that'll happen where I'll get a cluster of sightings, people describing a similar thing. But it is, you're right, from an ecological perspective, it doesn't make a lot of sense that you would have, presumably an ectothermic animal or something with a lower metabolism like that, living in that. Now, there is, of course, controversy on that subject as well, because some paleontologists are speculating that pterosaurs may in fact have been warm-blooded. They did; their bodies were covered with these kind of proto-feather type of structures. So they looked, in some respects, the purpose of that would have been to help insulate body temperature. So, there's a lot of speculation that not just in cryptozoology, Paul, but even in real traditional science, there's a lot of speculation that goes on because there's just not enough information. So perhaps it's not totally impossible that something like a pterosaur could survive in a temperate climate. Who knows?
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think, in our lifetime, we've seen the traditional train of thought when it comes to dinosaurs from a lot of people believing they were solely all reptiles to quite a considerable number were actually part of the bird lineage, and that's that whole sphere of knowledge has only really come about over the last 30 years or so.
Yeah, well, perfect example. As you say, the models keep changing, and that happens in traditional science all the time, which is one of the stronger arguments in favor of cryptozoology. The fact new things are being discovered and learned constantly. So
yeah, absolutely. I was fortunate enough to speak to Ron Moorhead in regards to his experiences over the years, and he was very much of a similar ilk that I have, that I sometimes find it frustrating that when it comes to dealing with subjects such as this, Ken, that the vast majority of normal science will just not give it any credit whatsoever. Whereas for me, I think regardless, that there has been enough discoveries in the animal kingdom over just the last 25 years. We can look at the giant squid for a prime example as a legendary beast that couldn't possibly exist to being something that we know exists. We just don't see it very often.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And many times on that point, I think completely natural behaviors can be interpreted as almost supernatural sometimes. If you look throughout the animal kingdom, you see a number of animals with all types of amazing adaptations, things that are just literally mind-blowing. And so one of my theories, for example, with regard to Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the Yeti, is that these are hominids that have adapted avoidance behaviors towards humans. They view us essentially as their direct competition, and therefore they've adapted a variety of avoidance behaviors that include living in the remotest areas, wilderness areas where we typically don't go, being highly nomadic, moving around quite a bit, nocturnal, and also just keenly aware when we're coming into their area, and that they're always able to quickly vanish. And I think that's a lot of people like to anoint Bigfoot with these supernatural abilities. Well, it vanished. Well, you know, if any outdoorsman will tell you, Paul, that you can be standing within a few feet of an animal such as a deer, and it'll take a few steps into the brush and literally vanish right before your eyes. And it's, you're standing less than 10 feet away from it, but this thing has learned how to camouflage itself. It's remaining very still. And so, you know, things can be interpreted as kind of supernatural when, in fact, they're very natural behaviors and things that, you know, that really boggle our minds because it's just, they're so unexpected.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a prime example of camouflage, I think, which is a very underestimated trait for in the animal kingdom, I think, and people just, like you say, tend to overlook the standard adaptations that animals on every continent show us on a daily basis, Ken. I think it was in India where there was a tiger in a field which was literally 10 foot away from a couple of guys sat on top of an elephant who were looking for it. And the first the first time they see it is when it's on them. It just literally leaps from nowhere and it's 10 foot in the air straight away. It's incredible footage. And that is something that you can see clearly that animal is able to keep them in eye line and they hadn't got a clue it was there.
Yeah, that's a perfect example right there, as you say. So never underestimate the majesty and kind of the wonder of the natural world and you know what different animals and species are capable of.
I think it's an intriguing one as well because one of the other strange correlations when it comes to cryptids that I've noticed is mystery black cats. They seem to be not only in North America, but obviously there's a constant procession of sightings here in the UK as well as Australia.
Absolutely.
And that's extremely odd because especially for both the UK and Australia, we've no history of a large cat, you know, being here in anything pre, you know, the last ice age. Whereas obviously for yourselves in America, you have got a history of large cats, you know, being sporadically spread across the whole of the country. But it's the fact that these cats tend to be melanistic, which is incredibly intriguing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating mystery. And, you know, it also serves as a strong example that many of the cryptids that we investigate, Paul, are cases of what, and this is Dr. Carl Schuchter's term, so I'll give him credit for this, but composite identity.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of cryptids or bits and pieces of different other things kind of thrown together. And at the root of all of these mysteries, there probably is perhaps a bona fide animal that's been sighted. But for example, in with regard to the quote-unquote alien big cats or black panthers, I know here in the States I've debunked a couple of a videotape and sightings that turned out to be just basically large black house cats. People have sighted, for example, interpretation becomes involved when you talk about people sometimes at night or in poor lighting or if an animal is coming out of the, if its fur is wet, it can look darker. Or in certain lighting, perhaps it looks black or melanistic, but when in fact it's not. So, I mean, there are those cases too that kind of add to the mystery. Or you have cases of misinterpretation, or sadly, downright fabrications. But at the root of it, usually some genuine animal, perhaps at the root of it, but other things kind of get mixed up into the whole lot. And it's, you know, again, we're talking about what we were talking about a few minutes ago, is just disseminating the information. But you're right, it is remarkable that we have these accounts of big black melanistic cats from the UK and parts of Europe and North America and Australia, where literally the only continents where those types of cats should not exist, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Australia is a fascinating example because essentially cats have never been there until Europeans discovered it and fetched the domestic cat, as it were. But regardless, they still, I mean, it's an ongoing constant, same as the UK. They are absolutely convinced that they've got, be it a melanistic population that's out there or just some kind of large cat, they are convinced that they have an alien population there. And I would tend to suspect, because Australia is a vast country that I think people don't understand just how big it actually is out there.
Right.
I would not be surprised in the slightest that something, because cats by their nature are naturally stealthy and secretive. It would not surprise me in the slightest that there's not necessarily a melanistic cat, but some kind of cougar or leopard or population, because Australia seems to be very welcoming to invasive species.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, that same argument kind of goes along to the Yowie as well. You know, you're talking about, if you look at the other fauna of, you know, Australia, obviously been so separated. How did something like a hominid or a primate get to Australia if in fact that's what people are describing? But, you know, an interesting thing, one last interesting point on the Black Panthers, Paul. Here in North America, we have kind of two far out theories that perhaps are not so far out. One being that there are melanistic jaguars that have migrated up from Central America and Mexico into the United States. Probably unlikely, but not totally impossible. There have been melanistic jaguars spotted in parts of northwest Mexico. And then, of course, the other theory, we do have a healthy population of puma concolor, the puma or mountain lion cougar, which is the most widespread mammal in the Americas, very successful animal. And, of course, the argument there is, you know, there's never been a definitive case of a melanistic or a black mountain lion. Well, that's true, but it's not impossible that they could, at some point, they could have a melanistic gene that would surface. But, you know, an interesting thing, recently I've kind of come full circle in terms of the theory that a lot of these alien big cats are escapes, and I think that would be the strongest argument in the UK, is that these black panthers are escaped leopards and pets that people have released into the wild and so on and so forth. But having worked with the San Antonio Zoo now for a few years and owners of different big cat sanctuaries and so forth, when exotic animals like black leopards do escape, they're actually found fairly easily, Paul. They typically don't go too far. They don't adapt well to the new environment, and so they're recaptured rather quickly. So I think that kind of dispels a lot of the theories that have been out there for a long time, that a lot of these alien big cats are escaped animals that have somehow acclimated to a new habitat and developed a viable breeding population.
Yeah, and I've always found it peculiar that it's one particular type of cat that people see around the world. It's not, you know, you don't see tigers in Australia or lions in the UK. They are all, mostly, the reports are all of black cats, which I find equally strange as well.
That is, that's an interesting point.
You know, it's not so long ago. I mean, obviously, it's a very well-known story here that, you know, up until the 1960s, you could go into Harrods in London and you could buy yourself a lion as they're in their pet room. There's a wonderful video. I'll send you the link, and it's a story called Christian the Lion. It's about two guys who lived in a bookshop in London and they bought a pet lion. And ended up taking him to Africa to release him. I'll not spoil it, but and that happened in 1967.
Wow.
So, you know, that's, you know, just over 50 years ago, Ken, that you were able to walk onto the high street in London and buy yourself a big cat.
Well, that's, you know, you get similar stories here in the US. People in downtown in Manhattan, New York, with tigers in their apartments and things like that. So,
yes,
you gotta wonder what people are thinking, but but you know, there's an interesting, there may always be some kind of interesting psychological or sociological component to these cryptid cases as well, and that, again, that goes back to the composite identity thing. Why is it that people see these black panthers so much? Is there something sort of in our unconscious mind, something that's part of our common human condition that, you know, almost colors, you know, whatever these animals are and paints them black, if you will, you know, metaphorically. So that's how humans tend to want to interpret these things, maybe on an unconscious level. So,
yeah, I mean, I think the one of the strangest theories I ever saw, because there is a wonderful breed of dog from Italy, And I've forgotten the name of the breed. But essentially, if you didn't realise it, if somebody didn't tell you it was a dog, you would perhaps think it was a very large black panther. I've forgotten what they're called, and they are stunning dogs. I strangely enough, on my way to work every day in the UK, I pass a scrapyard on a train, and they have two of these dogs, and they are stunningly beautiful. But from a distance, they do look like large black cats.
Yeah, that's I believe that's happened as well. I remember in some of the UK cases, Beast of Exmoor and some of those famous cases that they did find, or some people had reported black Labradors and other types of dogs as Black Panthers, and that probably has happened in the States as well, you know.
Yeah, very much so. I think one of the other in your marvelous book, A Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts, one of the intriguing chapters and parts that caught my attention was the bit about the duendes of Central America, because up until reading your book, I'd always associated the duende as more as a South America, specifically in Argentina, and resembling something like a gnome. But obviously, what you cover in your book seems to be quite a different type of creature.
Yeah, well, actually, the first person to kind of bring the duende into the attention of the cryptozoological community was Ivan Sanderson, who lived at that time, it was British Honduras, and he lived there during World War II along with his wife Alma. And he got to know many of the locals, and in particular the local forestry rangers that worked kind of on the edge of the forest in the Maya Mountains. And he began to collect reports of these small, hair-covered human-like beings that were being spotted at the edges of farms in the lower parts of the Maya Mountains. And so Ivan was the first one to write about the duende, not as a, as you said, a kind of mythological folkloric elf gnome type of creature, but as something as more of a kind of a relic hominid. And Sanderson, of course, in his classic work, Abominable Snowmen: Legend Come to Life, wrote about the quote-unquote proto-pygmies. So the duende was one of these, but of course he mentioned the Orang Pendek or Tsedapa, the Agagwe and Sahite of Africa, the Shiru of Ecuador, and so on, Didi. So the duende, he kind of put in this particular category, and I was fascinated by the possibility of some of these proto-pygmy beings actually existing, and furthermore, living in Belize, which is, you know, where I live here in Texas. That's really not too far. You just jump on a plane and it's a couple hours and you're there. So yeah, now many of the locals, in fairness, many of the locals that I interviewed about the duende did still kind of perceive it as more of a kind of a fairy or an elf or a gnome type of being with magical powers. Often portrayed with, you know, the ability to vanish. A lot of the common tropes or themes that you hear about from around the world about the little people, you know, they like to kidnap children and things like that. So Sanderson is really still the main source for those kind of little hair-covered duende reports, although a notable zoologist by the name of Alan Rabinowitz, who actually founded the world's largest jaguar sanctuary in Belize, the Coxcomb Sanctuary, claimed that he saw a small man-like figure at the edge of the woods one night, the silhouette of one at least. And so that's a pretty credible, although he didn't get a real clear sighting of the thing, Rabinowitz was pretty freaked out by it, and he's a pretty credible source in terms of being a world recognized zoologist. So, you know, but there are reports of these kind of little hairy little people around the world. I personally think that they might be at the stem of a lot of the little people folklore from around the world. It's not so far-fetched, Paul, that a species of relic hominid, something that's pygmy-sized, did survive into modern times. And, of course, the fabulous discovery of the past 16 years or so was the so-called Hobbit, Homo floresiensis, which was a diminutive 3-foot-tall non-human species that lived alongside human beings as recently as 50,000 years ago. Mm. And additionally, there was a recent paper written by an anthropologist named Mark Collard from Simon Fraser University in Canada, who determined that the great radiation out of Africa almost 2 million years ago did not consist of Homo erectus as previously thought, but rather Homo habilis, which was this little, you know, the first being in the human line, which was this little 3.5-4 foot tall human-like creature, and that Homo floresiensis shares many of the Homo habilis characteristics, as does Homo georgicus, the fossil hominids that were discovered in the nation of Georgia in recent years. So if you have this model or this archetype of little, hairy, man-like pre-human ancestors migrating out of Africa and traveling around the world, you know, at least the old world, until about 50,000 years ago, you know, perhaps it's not that much of a stretch to speculate that pockets of these little humanoids, hominids, have just survived into modern times. Yeah. And if so, they perfectly explain a lot of the little people legends from all over the world.
Yeah, and I think you took the words right out of my mouth, because I was going to say exactly about Homo floresiensis, that alone is one of those things, because even if you look at the discoveries that we've made in human evolution in regards to that, you know, 25 years ago, it was humans and Neanderthals, and that was it. But we've discovered three other species since then, because obviously we've got the Denisovians as well as Homo floresiensis, and I think there was another species identified earlier this year as well from a similar out in the Philippines.
Yeah, Homo luzonensis.
Yeah, so straight away then we've got, it wouldn't be a leap of faith in my opinion either, Ken, that those types of populations are clearly some kind of archetype for the modern proliferation of stories of little people in specific areas of the world.
Yeah. Absolutely. It could be a kind of a ancestral memory that's been passed down. Mm-hmm. But, you know, similar to many of the other cryptids we've talked about, the black cats and Bigfoot, I mean, you have seemingly a worldwide distribution of these little hairy man beings. And this is something I write about in my new Bigfoot book. I refer to them as Littlefoot. It's kind of a playing off of Bigfoot. But, but in fact, the Yeti. You know, most people think of the Yeti as kind of the Gigantopithecus model of this giant hulking thing. Yeah. But I recently was talking to Peter Byrne, who, of course, was searching for the Yeti starting in the 1950s and spent many years in the Himalayas. Yeah. And I recently asked Peter, you know, what the Yeti was, and he definitively stated that the Yeti is only 4 feet tall. It's not at all like a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch in that 7 to 8 foot range. That all of the accounts that he collected in the Himalayas from the Sherpa people and others indicated that the Yeti was kind of this small, little, squat, hairy man-like creature, more of a Littlefoot type thing.
Yes, I mean, there's a name to evoke memories, Peter Byrne. I mean, he's one of the legends, and obviously one of the original Four Horsemen, as they were known back when this first sort of crossed into the mainstream. So I found that kind of really interesting, because the Yeti is probably one of the most mysterious, primarily, I think, because it's in such an area of the world that it's so hard to really get in there and you know, have a proper study of such a creature.
Yeah, it is really challenging, and that is, in fact, why Tom Slick and Peter Byrne shifted their efforts from the Himalayas to Northern California in 1959, when the Bigfoot tracks started showing up. At first, they were both incredulous. Oh, there's no way something like the Yeti could be running around in the U.S. But you know, as they began to look into it more, they became convinced. And logistically, it was much easier. You know, they had a system of roads and communications and a lot of advantages that they didn't have in the Himalayas. So, in that respect, the Yeti may remain undiscovered because of the challenge of that particular habitat. Although, if he's crossing over Mount Everest during the months of May and June, he may very well get discovered. maybe that's not an appropriate. I thought it was timely, considering all of the
Yeah.
Stories we're getting.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things that you think, you know, we consider, you know, Mount Everest is obviously the largest and tallest mountain on Earth. But, you know, we've seen some recent pictures of people queuing up as though they're trying to get into the cinema. It's incredible.
Yeah. It's crazy.
And then you hear the stories and see the camps, and you just think that there are literally hundreds of people there going there every year. And you think, well, is it really that hard? I mean, without taking anything away, I'm purely being flippant there, Ken. But it's as stunning as the ascending of the mountain, I think, to see that many people who want to attempt it.
Yeah, and it's off subject, I know, but I read an article about the ecological impact, the amount of human waste and other things, just garbage that's being abandoned on the mountain is creating a lot of problems. It's very sad right now. But yeah, you're right. A lot of the romance of Everest and the Himalayas, I guess, has eroded with the huge tourist boom that's going on there. So
yeah, very much so. It'd be
perhaps the Yeti's moved on, I guess, to another location.
Yes, popped over to K2 instead. It's a bit safer over there. Yeah, I'll just move down the hillside a little bit out of the way and try and keep my distance. But it's always been very fascinating, and you know, like you refer to, I've spoken to several people. I think, you know, you mentioned we touched on Peter Byrne there, Ken, but I've spoken to several people and their interactions and when they've had conversations with Peter, is Peter's often thought perhaps unfairly as a complete believer in Bigfoot, and yet everybody I've spoke to often points to Peter's skepticism about a lot of the reports he received.
Well, yeah, I mean, full credit to Peter, and bless his heart, I think he's 93 now. He doesn't really get out in the field anymore, but he's definitely the last of the horsemen. Peter was always very skeptical. You know, he spent decades out in Northern California. Even after the Yeti expeditions, he spent decades out in Oregon and Northern California. And he was really one of the few well-funded, if not the only well-funded investigator for years. He had grants from the Academy of Applied Sciences, and there was a millionaire in Ohio named Tom Page. So he had Tom Slick. So he always had people kind of backing him, and rightfully so, because he had an amazing background as a big game hunter in the Himalayas. But Peter's always been very skeptical, and after all those decades in the field, he never had a sighting. I believe he only claims he found about 16 or so trackways. He was able to explain a number of sightings and track incidences, misidentifications of bears and things. So yeah, Peter was always very level-headed, and I think he still is. I think he always has kind of had a very objective, you know, rightfully so, the way you have to get into this field, you know. Always kind of very critically analyzing all of the evidence that came his way. So, you know, I think he deserves a lot more credit than he's gotten through the years. And moreover, what I've gotten to know from Peter is that, you know, he is a true gentleman in the truest sense of the word. He, unlike some of the other horsemen that often got into infighting and squabbling and things like that, he always managed to kind of stay above the fray. So I definitely respect that about him.
Yeah, very much so. He seemed to have a very warm personality, even in the most challenging of critics, I think is my general perception of Peter over the years. So yep. Before I let you go, Ken, so you've touched on it a couple of times. You're currently completing a new book, and it's about Bigfoot. So is that just focusing in on North America, or are you looking at hominids around the world?
It's primarily North America, Bigfoot and Sasquatch, although there are, of course, references to the Yeti and some of the other mystery hominids around the world. But primarily it's centered on North America. Who knows, perhaps someday I'll take on more of a global view of mystery hominids once I've had an opportunity to branch out a little bit more. But yeah, that's what I'm working on at the moment. The Essential Guide to Bigfoot is going to be kind of a primer. Technical in some respects, but you know, just trying to push back against the vast amount of misinformation out there, Paul, by printing as much accurate, verified information that's been collected, you know, not just by myself, but by three generations of Bigfoot researchers for many years. And, you know, additionally, I do lectures around North America from time to time. And, yeah, if people want to get more information or get in touch, I have a website, kengerhard.com.
Yeah.
I also have a Facebook page, Ken Gerhard Cryptozoologist, and I would love to hear from anyone out there who has a question or an experience they'd like to share.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Ken. It's been an absolute pleasure. Looking forward to the book. So when's the book due for release? Have you got? Is it going to be this year?
Yes, I'm aiming for late September.
Oh, well, lovely. Well, listen, if it comes out and you've got time in your schedule, I'd love to have a chat with you about it when it's released, if that's all right.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. I'd love to do that.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. Well, listen, thanks again today for your time. It's been a real pleasure. So thank you and enjoy the rest of your day. You take care.
Thank you, Paul. You have a great day.
Thank you.
Cheers. Mm-hmm.